She looked into his eyes. He dropped down when she let go, and she stooped down to his level. "I'm going away for a while," she said softly to the animal, repeating the meaning in the sign language of the clan, though it was inconspicuous to most of those watching. Sometimes Wolf seemed to comprehend hand signals even better than words, but she generally used both when she was trying to communicate something important to him.
"Folara is going to watch Janela and Sethona. You can stay here with the babies and watch them too, but you must do what Folara tells you. Jandalar will be nearby."
She stood up and hugged her baby and said goodbye to the others. Jandalar embraced her briefly as they pressed cheeks, and then she left. She wouldn't say even to herself that Wolf really understood everything she said, but when she talked to him like that, he paid close attention to her and did seem to follow her instructions. She had noticed that the Zelandani of the 26th cave had followed them, and she knew he saw her with Wolf. His face still showed his surprise, though it wasn't obvious to everyone. Ayla was accustomed to reading meaning from subtle nuances. It was necessary in the language of the clan, and she had learned to apply the skill to interpreting unconscious meaning in her own kind. The man didn't say anything as they fell into step and walked back to the Zelandania dwelling together, but he had been astounded when she bared her throat to the wolf's fangs. The 26th cave had gone to a different summer meeting the year before, and he hadn't seen her with the animal when she first arrived. First, he was surprised to see a hunting meat-eater calmly approaching with the people of the 9th cave. Then he was amazed at the size of the animal. When he saw Wolf jump up on his hind legs, he was sure it was the biggest one of his kind he had ever seen. Of course, he'd never been quite so close to a living wolf before, but the animal was nearly as tall as the woman. He had heard that the first's new acolyte had a way with animals, and that a wolf followed her around, but he knew how people exaggerated, and while he didn't deny what anyone said, wasn't sure he fully believed it either. Perhaps a wolf had been seen near the meeting, and people were led to believe it was watching her. But this wasn't a creature skulking around the outskirts of the group, who may have been watching her from a distance, as he'd imagined. There was direct communication, understanding, and trust between them. The Zelandani of the 26th cave had never seen anything like it, and it piqued his interest in Ayla even more. Young mother or not, perhaps she did belong in the Zelandania. It was well into the morning by the time the small group approached the unremarkable cave in the face of a low limestone cliff. There were four of them: the Zelandani of the 26th cave, his acolyte, a quiet young man named Phelathon, although he often referred to himself as the first acolyte of the Zelandani of the 26th, Jonakol, the talented artist who had been the first acolyte the year before, and Ayla. She had enjoyed talking to Jonakol along the way, though it made her realize how much he had changed in the last year. When she first met him, he was more artist than acolyte, and had joined the Zelandania because it allowed him to freely exercise his talent. He had no great desire to become a Zelandani. He was content to remain an acolyte. But that had changed. He had become more serious, she thought. He wanted to paint the white cave that she, or rather Wolf, had found the previous summer, but not just for the joy of the art. He knew it was a remarkably hallowed place, a sacred refuge created by the mother, whose white calcite walls offered an extraordinary invitation to be made into a distinctive place to commune with the world of the spirits. He wanted to know that world as a Zelandani, so he could do justice to its sanctity when he created the images from the next world that he was sure would speak to him. Jonakol would soon be Zelandani of the 19th cave and give up his personal name, Ayla realized. The entrance to the small cave seemed barely large enough for a person to enter, and it seemed to get smaller as she looked farther inside. It made Ayla wonder why anyone would want to go inside it. Then she heard a sound that made the hair on the back of her neck stand on end and goose flesh appear on her arms. It was like a yodel, but faster and more high-pitched, an ululating wail that seemed to fill the cave hole in front of them. She turned and saw that it was Phelathon who was making the sound. Then a strange, muted echo reverberated faintly back to them that did not quite synchronize with the original sound, but seemed to originate from deep inside the cave. When he finished, she saw Zelandani of the 26th smiling at her. "It's quite a remarkable sound he makes, isn't it?" the man said.
"Yes, it is," Ayla said. "But why did he make it?"
"It's one way we test the cave. When a person sings or plays a flute or makes a sound like Phelathon in a hollow, if the cave responds, sings back with a sound that is true and distinctive, it means the mother is telling us that she hears, and she is telling us that one can enter the spirit world from here. Then we know it is a sacred place," the 26th said.
"Do all sacred caves sing back?" Ayla asked.
"Not all, but most do, and some only in certain places. But there is always something special about sacred places," he said.
"I am sure the first would be able to test a cave like this. She has such a beautiful and pure voice," Ayla said, and then she frowned. "What if you want to test the cave, but you can't sing or play a flute or make a sound like Phelathon?" "I can't do any of those things."
"Surely you can sing a little." "No, she can't," Jonicol said. "She speaks the words of the mother's song and hums in a monotone." "You have to be able to test a sacred site with sound," the Zelandani of the 26th cave said. "That's an important part of being Zelandani, and it must be a true sound of some kind. You can't just yell or scream."
He seemed gravely concerned, and Ayla was crestfallen.
"What if I can't make the right kind of sound, a true sound?" Ayla said, realizing at that moment that she did want to be a Zelandani someday. But what if she couldn't? Just because she couldn't make a proper sound.
Jonicol looked as unhappy as Ayla. He liked the foreigner Jondalar had brought back with him from his journey, and he felt he owed her a debt. She was not only the one who found the beautiful new cave, she had made sure he was among the first to see it, and had agreed to become the first acolyte, which had allowed him to move to the 19th cave, which was near it.
"But you can make a true sound, Ayla," Jonicol said. "You can whistle. I have heard you whistle, just like a bird. And you can make many other animal sounds. You can whinny like a horse. You can even roar like a lion."
"That I'd like to hear," the Danyer said.
"Go ahead, Ayla. Show him," Jonicol said.
Ayla closed her eyes and gathered up her thoughts to concentrate. She put her mind back to the time when she was living in her valley and raising a young lion alongside a horse, as though they were both her children. She remembered the first time Baby managed to make a full-throated roar. She had decided to practice making the sound, too, and a few days later answered him with a roar of her own. It wasn't quite as thunderous as his, but he recognized it as a respectable roar. Like Baby, she had always built up to it with a series of distinctive grunts and began with a series of unk, unk, unk sounds that grew louder with each repetition. Finally, she opened her mouth and pushed out the loudest roar she could. It filled the small cave. Then, after a period of silence, the roar echoed back on itself with a distant, muted sound that, with a chill of goose flesh, made each of them feel that a different lion had answered from a place far away, deep in the cave and beyond.
"If I didn't know better, I'd vow there was a lion in here," the young acolyte of the 26th said with a smile when the echoes died down.
Can you really whinny like a horse, too?
That one was easy. It was the true name of Ayla's horse, Winnie, the one she named her when she was a foal, though now she more often said it like a word than a whinny. She made the sound the way she usually greeted her friend when she hadn't seen her for a while, a happy, welcoming... This time the donyer of the 26th cave laughed out loud.
And I imagine you can whistle like a bird, too.
Ayla smiled, a big, delighted grin, then whistled through a series of bird calls that she had taught herself when she was still alone in her valley and had learned to coax birds to eat out of her hand. The bird trills and chirps and whistles reverberated with the strangely muted echoing of the cave.
Well, if I had any doubts about this being a sacred cave, I couldn't any more. And you won't have any problem testing with sound, Ayla, even if you can't sing or play a flute. Like Phelathon, you have your own way, the Zelandani said.
Then he signaled to his acolyte, who removed his back frame and took out of it four small bowls with handles that had been carved out of limestone. The acolyte next brought out an object that looked like a small white sausage. It was a piece of the intestine of some animal filled with fat. He untwisted one end and squeezed out some of the slightly congealed fat into the bowl of each lamp, then put a strip of dried boletus mushroom into each. Then he sat down and prepared to make a small fire. Ayla watched him and almost offered to make a fire with one of her firestones, but the first had made a point the previous year to make a ceremony of showing the firestone, and though many of the Zelandanyi now knew how to use it, Ayla wasn't sure how she wanted to show those who hadn't seen it the first time. Using materials he had brought with him, Phelathon soon had a small fire going, and from it, using another strip of dried mushroom to transfer the fire, he melted some of the fat to make it more easily absorbed, then lit the mushroom wicks. When the fire was well established in each grease lamp, the Zelandani of the 26th said,
"Well, shall we explore this tight little cave? But you will have to assume that you are another animal, Ayla, a snake. Do you think you can slither in here?"
Ayla nodded her assent, though she felt some doubt. Holding on to the handle of the small bowl-shaped lamp, the Zelandani of the 26th cave put his head into the small opening first, getting down on his knees and one hand, and finally down on his stomach. Pushing the small oil lamp in front of him, he squirmed into the unique little space. Ayla followed him, then Jonacol, and finally Phelathon, each of them holding a lamp. She now understood why the Zelandani had discouraged the first from attempting to enter the place, though Ayla had occasionally been surprised at what the large woman could do if she set her mind to it. This cave really was too small for her. The short walls were more or less perpendicular to the floor, but curved together at the ceiling, and appeared to be rock-covered with a damp soil. The floor was a wet, clayey mud that stuck to them, but actually helped them to slide through some of the tighter places. But it didn't take long for the cold, clammy muck to seep into their clothing. The chill made Ayla aware that her breasts were full of milk, and she tried to get up on her elbows so she wouldn't have to put all her weight on them, though it was difficult while holding the lamp. Small spaces didn't particularly bother Ayla, but when she got stuck in one place that curved sideways, she began to feel a touch of panic.
"Just relax, Ayla. You can make it," she heard Jonacol say, then felt a push against her feet from behind. With his help, she squeezed through.
The cave was not uniformly small. When they got beyond the constriction, the cave opened up a little. They could actually sit up, and holding their lamps up, see each other. They stopped and rested for a while. Then Jonacol couldn't resist. He took a small, chisel-pointed piece of flint from a pouch tied to his waist thong, and with a few quick strokes, engraved a drawing of a horse on the wall on one side, and then in front of it, another. It had always amazed Ayla how skilled he was. When he was still at the ninth cave, she had often watched him when he practiced on the outside wall of a limestone cliff or a slab of stone that had broken off, or on a section of rawhide with a piece of charcoal, or even on a smoothed-out area of dirt on the ground. He did it so often, and with such ease, he almost seemed profligate, wasteful of his talent. But just as she had had to practice to gain skill with her sling or Jondalar's spear-thrower, she knew Jonacol had needed to practice to gain his level of proficiency. It was just that, to her, the ability to think of a living, breathing animal and reproduce its likeness on a surface was so extraordinary. It couldn't be anything but a great and amazing gift from the mother. Ayla was not alone in those feelings. After they rested a while, the Zelandani of the 26th cave continued leading the way into the cave. They encountered a few more tight places before they reached a place where slabs of rock blocked their way. It was the end of the cave. They could go no farther.
"I noticed that you felt compelled to make drawings on the wall of this cave," the Zelandani of the 26th said, smiling at Jonacol.
Jonacol wasn't sure he would put it quite that way, but he had drawn two horses, so he nodded assent.
"I have been thinking that Sunview should have a ceremony for this space. I am now more sure than ever that it is sacred, and I would like to acknowledge that. It could be a place for young people who want to test themselves to come, even those who are quite young."
"I think you are right," the artist acolyte said. "It's a difficult cave, but straightforward. It would be hard to get lost in here."
"Would you join us in the ceremony, Jonacol?"
Ayla guessed the Zelandani wanted Jonacol to make more drawings in this sacred cave that was so close to them, and wondered if his drawings would add more status to the place.
"I believe a mark of closure is needed here, to show it is as far as one can go within the cave, in this world," Jonacol said, then smiled. "I think Ayla's lion spoke from the next world. Let me know when you plan to have the ceremony."
Both the Zelandani and his acolyte, Phaelathon, smiled their pleasure.
"You are welcome to come too, Ayla," the 26th said.
"I will have to see what the first has planned for me," she said.
"Of course."
They turned around and started back, and Ayla was glad. Her clothes were soggy and caked with mud, and she was getting cold. It didn't seem to take as long to return, and she was happy that she didn't get stuck again. When they reached the entrance, Ayla breathed a sigh of relief. Her oil lamp had gone out just before they saw light coming in from outside. This may be a truly sacred cave, she thought, but she didn't think it was a particularly pleasant cave, especially having to crawl on her stomach most of the way.
"Would you like to come visit Sunview, Ayla? It's not very far,"
Phaelathon said.
"I am sorry. Some other time I would love to visit, but I told Proliva I would be back in the afternoon. She is watching Janela, and I really do need to go back to the camp," Ayla said.
She didn't add that her breasts were aching. She was feeling the need to nurse and getting very uncomfortable. Chapter 8 When Ayla returned, Wolf was waiting at the edge of the summer meeting camp to greet her. He had somehow known she was coming.
"Where's Janela, Wolf? Find her for me."
The animal dashed out in front of her, then turned to look back and make sure she was following him. He led her directly to Proliva, who was at the camp of the third cave, nursing Janela.
"Ayla, you're back. If I'd known you were coming, I would have held off. I'm afraid she's full now," the woman said.
Ayla took her child and tried to nurse her, but the infant just wasn't hungry, which seemed to make Ayla's breasts ache even more.
"Has Sethona nursed? I'm full, too, full of milk." Stallona was helping me today, and she always has plenty of milk, even though her baby is eating some regular food. She offered to feed Sethona not long ago, when I was talking to Zelandani about the matrimonial. Since I knew I'd be feeding Janela soon, I thought that would be perfect. I just didn't know when you would be back, Ayla.
I didn't either, Ayla said. I'll see if I can find someone else who needs milk. And thank you for taking care of Janela today.
Walking towards the big Zelandania lodge, Ayla saw Lenoga carrying Lorela on her hip. 3-year Ganimar, the next to the youngest in the family, was holding on to her tunic with one hand, the thumb of his other hand firmly in his mouth. Ayla hoped that Lorela might want to nurse. She was usually ready any time. When she mentioned it, Lenoga told her, much to her relief, that she was looking for someone to feed the child. They sat on one of several logs with seating pads on them that were arranged around a darkened fireplace outside the entrance of the big lodge, and Ayla gratefully took the older baby in exchange for her own. Wolf sat down near Janela, and Ganimar plopped down beside him. All the children of Larimar's hearth were comfortable around the animal, though Larimar was not. He still tensed up and backed away when the big wolf came near him. Ayla had to wipe her breast off before she could nurse the child. The wet mud had soaked through. While Ayla was feeding Lorela, Jondalar returned from an afternoon of spear-throwing practice, and Lenadar was with him. He smiled shyly at her, and more warmly at Lenoga. Ayla gave him a quick, appraising look. He was a 12-year now, close to a 13-year, and he'd grown quite a bit in the past year. Even more in self-confidence, she noticed. He was taller, and he wore a unique spear-thrower holder, a kind of harness that she could see accommodated his deformed right arm. It also held a quiver of several of the specialized spears that were used with a spear-thrower, which were shorter and lighter than the usual spears meant to be cast by hand, more like long darts tipped with sharp flint. His well-developed left arm looked almost as strong as a grown man's, and she suspected he had been practicing with the weapon. Lanadar was also wearing a manhood belt with a red fringe, a narrow, finger-woven strip of various colors and fibers. Some were natural vegetal colors like ivory flax, beige dogbane, and taupe nettles. Others were the natural fibers of animal fur, usually the dense long coat of winter kills, like white mouflon, gray ibex, dark red mammoth, and black horsetail. Most of the fibers could also be dyed to change or intensify the natural colors. The belt not only announced that he had reached physical maturity and was ready for a Danyi woman and manhood rites, but the designs indicated his affiliations. Ayla was able to identify the symbolism that proclaimed he was of the 19th cave of the Zelandanyi, though she couldn't yet identify his primary names and ties by their distinctive patterns. The first time Ayla had seen a manhood belt, she had thought it was beautiful. She'd had no way then of knowing its meaning, however, when Morona, the woman who had expected to mate Jondalar, tried to embarrass her by tricking her into wearing it, along with the winter undergarments of a young man. She still thought the belt ties were beautiful, though they reminded her of the unpleasant incident. She had, however, kept the soft buckskin garments the woman had given her. Ayla wasn't born to the Zelandanyi, and in spite of their intended use, she didn't have the ingrained, culture-driven sense that they were inappropriate. They were comfortably soft, suede leather, velvety to the touch, and she decided she would wear them sometimes after she made some adjustments to the leggings and tunic so they fit her womanly shape better. People of the 9th cave looked at her strangely the first time she wore the undergarments of a young man as casual outer clothing in warm weather to go hunting, but they got used to it. After a while, she noticed that some of the younger women started wearing similar clothing, but it embarrassed and angered Morona when Ayla wore them, because she was reminded that her trick had not been appreciated by the Ninth Cave. Instead, they felt that she had disgraced them by treating the foreigner, who was destined to become one of them, so maliciously. Distressing Morona had not been Ayla's original intention when she first wore teenage boys' undergarments publicly, but the woman's reaction was not lost on her. As Ayla and Lenoga exchanged babies again, several laughing young men approached, most of them wearing manhood belts, and several of them carrying spear throwers. Jondalar attracted people wherever he went, but young men in particular looked up to him and liked to cluster around him. She was pleased to note that they greeted Lanadar in a friendly way. Since he had developed such skill with the new weapon, his deformed arm no longer caused the other young men to avoid him. She was also pleased to note that Bolagan was among them, though he lacked both a manhood belt and a spear thrower of his own. She knew Jondalar had made several of the hunting weapons for people to practice. Ayla knew that both men and women went to the practice spear-throwing sessions that Jondalar had begun to hold, but although the two genders were very aware of each other, the young men liked to socialize with their age mates who were going through the same stage of development and looking forward to the same rituals, and young women tended to avoid the boys with belts. Most of the young men glanced at Lenoga, but pretended to ignore her, except Bolagan. He did look at his sister, and she looked back, and though they didn't smile or nod a greeting, it was an acknowledgment. The boys all smiled at Ayla in spite of her mud-caked clothing, most of them shyly, but a couple were more bold in their appraisal of the beautiful older woman whom Jondalar had brought home and mated. Danyi women were invariably older and knew how to handle cocky boys trying to be men, to keep them in check without discouraging them too much. The impudent smile of some whom she hadn't met before was exchanged for a fleeting expression of apprehension when Wolf got up at her signal.
"Have you spoken to Proliva yet about the plans for tonight?"
Jondalar asked Ayla as she started toward the camp of the Ninth Cave. He smiled at the baby and tickled her, and received a delighted giggle in return.
"No, I just returned from the new sacred cave the first wanted me to see, and then went to find Jonayla. I'll ask her after I change," Ayla said, as they touched cheeks.
A couple of the young men, primarily the ones who were nervous about Wolf, looked surprised when Ayla spoke. It proclaimed her distant origins.
"Your clothes really are coated with mud,"
Jondalar said, wiping his hand on his pants after touching her.
"The cave had a very wet clay floor, and we had to crawl like a snake most of the time. The mud is cold and heavy, too. That's why I have to change."
"I'll walk back with you,"
Jondalar said. He hadn't seen Ayla all day. He took Jonayla in his arms so she would not get full of mud. When Ayla found Proliva again, she learned that the Ninth Cave, along with the Third Cave at the Third's camp, were hosting a meeting of the leaders of the rest of the caves and their assistants who were at this summer meeting. All their families would join them for the evening meal. Proliva had organized the preparation, which included some people to care for children so their mothers could help. Ayla signaled Wolf to come along. She noticed one or two women who looked uneasily at the carnivore, but was glad to see several people who recognized and welcomed Wolf, knowing what a help he could be in watching over them. Lenoga stayed to help mind the children. Ayla returned to see what Proliva wanted her to do. In the course of the evening, she did stop to nurse Jonayla, but there was so much work to do to prepare and cook the large feast, she hardly had the chance to hold her infant until after everyone ate, and then she was summoned to the Zelandania Lodge. She took Jonayla with her and signaled Wolf to follow. It was late and dark outside as she walked toward the large summer lodge along a path that had been laid with a paving of flat stones. She carried a torch, though light from various fireplaces lit her way reasonably well. She left the torch outside, propped up in a pile of rocks constructed to hold hot torches. Inside, a small fire near the edge of a larger fire ring and a few flickering lamps scattered here and there were glowing softly but gave scant illumination. Little could be seen beyond the lambent flames in the fireplace. She thought she heard someone snoring softly on the other side of the shelter, but she only saw Jonacle and the first. They were just within the circle of light, sipping cups of steaming tea. Without interrupting their conversation, the first nodded to Ayla and motioned for her to sit. Glad to finally have a chance to relax in quiet and comfort, she gratefully settled down on a well-stuffed seating cushion, one of several scattered around the fireplace, and began to nurse her child while she listened. Wolf sat down beside them. He was welcome inside the Zelandania Lodge most of the time. Ayla had been gone for some time during the day, and he didn't want to leave her or John Ayla.
"What was your impression of the cave?"
the large woman said, directing her comment to the young man.
"It is very small, hardly big enough to squeeze through in places, but quite long. An interesting cave,"
Jonacle said.
"Do you believe it is sacred?"
she asked.
"Yes, I do believe it is,"
the first nodded. She hadn't doubted the Zelandani of the 26th cave, but it was nice to have a corroborating opinion.
"And Ayla found her voice," Jonacle added, smiling at Ayla, who was listening to the conversation, unconsciously rocking in a desultory fashion as she nursed her child.
"She did,"
the older woman said.
"Yes," Jonacle said with a smile. "The 26th asked her to test the cave and was surprised when she said she couldn't sing or play a flute or do anything to test it. His acolyte, Phaelathon, sings a strong, high-pitched, ululating wail that's very unique. Then I suddenly remembered Ayla's bird calls and reminded her that she could whistle like a bird and whinny like a horse, even roar like a lion. So she did. All of them. Amazed the 26th, too, especially that roar. Her test substantiated the cave. When the roar came back, it was diminished but clear, more than audible, but seemed to be coming from a very distant place, the other place.
What did you think, Ayla?
The first asked, as she poured a cup of tea and handed it to Jonacle to give to her. She had noted that the infant had stopped nursing and fallen asleep in Ayla's arms with a dribble of milk running down the side of her mouth.
"It's a difficult cave to get into, and long, but not complicated. It could be frightening, especially where it narrows down to some very tight passages, but no one could get lost in it," Ayla said.
"From the way you describe this new cave, it makes me think that it might be especially good for young acolytes who want to test themselves, to find out if the life of a Zelandani is actually for them, if they're afraid of a small dark place that offers no real danger. I doubt that they could handle some of the other ordeals that truly can be perilous," the woman who was first said.
It made Ayla wonder what some of those ordeals might be. She had been in enough risky situations in her life already. She wasn't sure if she wanted to face more, but perhaps she should wait and see what would be asked of her. The sun was still low in the eastern sky, but a brilliant band of red fading to purple at the edges announced the coming day. A tinge of pink highlighted the thin nebulous bank of stratus clouds on the western horizon, reflecting the backside of the glowing sunrise. As early as it was, almost everyone was already at the main camp. It had rained, off and on, for several days, but this day looked more promising. Camping out when it rained was only endurable, never enjoyable.
"As soon as the first rites and matrimonial ceremonies are over, Zelandani wants to do some traveling," Ayla said, looking up at Jandalar. "She wants to begin my Dunyer tour with some of the closer sacred sites. We need to make that seat on a pole drag for her.
They were walking back from seeing to the horses before heading toward the meeting campground for a morning meal. Wolf had started out with them, but was distracted and dashed into the brush. Jandalar's brow wrinkled.
A trip like that could be interesting, but some people are talking about a big hunt after the ceremonies. Maybe going after a summer herd so we can begin drying meat for next winter. Joharan has been talking about how useful the horses can be in driving animals into surrounds. I think he's counting on us to help. How do we decide which one to do?
If she doesn't want to go too far, maybe we could do both, Ayla said.
She wanted to go with the first to visit sacred sites, but she also loved to hunt.
Perhaps, Jandalar said. Maybe we should talk to both Joharan and Zelandani and let them decide. But in any case, we could go ahead and make a pole drag seat for Zelandani. When we were making the summer shelter for Boligan and Lenoga and the rest of that family, I noticed some trees that I thought might work.
When do you think would be a good time to make it?
This afternoon, perhaps. I'll ask around to see if I can get a few people to help, Jandalar said.
Greetings, Ayla and Jandalar,
a familiar young voice said. It was Lenoga's younger sister, 9-year Trilara. They both turned around and saw all 6 of the children coming out of their summer shelter. Boligan tied the opening flap closed, then caught up with them. Neither Tremida nor Larimar was with them. Ayla knew the adults used the shelter sometimes, but they either had left earlier, or more likely, had not returned the night before. Ayla thought the children were probably heading to the meeting camp, hoping to find something to eat. People often made too much food, and someone was usually willing to give them the leftovers. They may not always have received the choicest selection, but they seldom went hungry.
"Greetings, children," Ayla said.
They all smiled at her, except Boligan, who tried to be more serious. When she first became familiar with the family, Ayla knew that Boligan, the eldest, stayed away from home as often as he could, preferring to associate with other boys, especially those who were more rowdy. But lately, it seemed to her, he was becoming more responsible toward the younger children, especially his brother Lavagan, who was a 7-year, and she'd seen him several times with Lanadar lately, which she thought was a good sign. Boligan walked up to Jandalar rather diffidently.
"Greetings, Jandalar," he said, looking down at his feet before raising his eyes to meet the man's.
"Greetings, Boligan," Jandalar said, wondering why he had been approached.
"Can I ask you something?" Boligan said.
"Of course."
The boy reached into a pocket-like fold of his tunic and pulled out a colorful manhood belt.
"Zelandani talked to me yesterday, then gave this to me. She showed me how to tie it, but I can't seem to make it look right," he said.
Well, he was a 13-year now, Ayla thought as she fought back a smile. He hadn't specifically asked Jandalar for help, but the tall man knew what he wanted. Typically, it was the man of a boy's hearth who gave him his manhood belt, usually made by his mother. Boligan was asking Jandalar to stand in for the man who should have been there for him. Jandalar showed the young man how to tie the belt. Then Boligan called to his brother and started out toward the main camp. The others followed behind more slowly. Ayla watched them go. 13-year Boligan walking beside 7-year Lavagan, 11-year Lenoga with Lorela, 1 year plus a half on her hip, and 9-year Trilara holding the hand of 3-year Ganimar. She remembered being told that one who would have been a 5-year had died in infancy. Though she and Jandalar helped them, and several others from the 9th cave as well, the children were essentially raising themselves. Neither their mother nor the man of their hearth paid much attention to them and did little to support them. She believed it was Lenoga who held them together, though now, she was glad to see, Trilara was helping her and Bolagan was more involved. She felt Janela moving in her carrying blanket, waking up. She pulled it around from her back to her front and took the baby out of it. She was naked, with no absorbent padding. Ayla held her out in front of her while the child wet on the ground. Jandalar smiled. None of the other women did that, and when he asked her, Ayla told him that was how clan mothers often took care of their children's wetting. Though she didn't do it all the time, it certainly saved time cleaning up messes and gathering materials that could soak up liquid. And Janela was getting so used to it, she tended to wait until she was out before she let go.
"Do you think Lanidar is still interested in Lanoga?"
Jandalar asked, obviously thinking about Tremida's children, too.
"He certainly gave her a warm smile when he first saw her this year," Ayla said. "How is he doing with the spear thrower? He looks to me as though he's been practicing with his left arm."
"He's good," Jandalar said. "Actually, it's amazing to watch him. He has some use of his right arm and uses it to help place the spear on the thrower, but he throws with great force and accuracy with his left arm. He's become quite a hunter and has gained the respect of his cave and more status. Now everyone at this summer meeting is looking at him with new eyes. Even the man of his hearth, who left his mother after he was born, has been showing an interest in him. And his mother and grandmother are no longer insisting that he go berry picking and food collecting with them all the time, for fear he won't be able to support himself any other way. They made that harness he wears, but he told them what he wanted. They give you credit for teaching him, you know."
"You taught him, too," she said. Then after a while she added, "He may have become a good hunter, but I still doubt that most mothers would want him to mate their daughters," Ayla said. "They would be afraid that the bad spirit that deformed his arm is still hovering and might give their daughters' children the same problem. When he said last year that he wanted to mate Lanoga when they grew up and help her raise her sisters and brothers, Proliva said she thought that would be a perfect pairing. Since Larimar and Tremida have the lowest status, no mother would want her son to mate with her, but I don't think anyone would put up much objection to Lanidar mating Lanoga, especially if he's a good hunter."
"No, but I'm afraid Tremida and Larimar will find a way to take advantage of him," Jandalar said. "I notice Lanoga isn't ready for first rites yet."
"But she will be soon. She's beginning to show signs. Maybe before the summer is over, the last first rites ceremony of the season. Have they asked you to assist with first rites this summer?" she asked, trying to seem unconcerned.
"Yes, but I told them I wasn't ready to take on that responsibility yet," he said, grinning at her. "Why? Do you think I should?"
"Only if you want to. There are some young women who might be very happy if you did. Perhaps even Lanoga," Ayla said, turning to look at Janela so he wouldn't see her face.
"Not Lanoga," he said. "That would be like sharing first rites with a child of my own hearth."
She turned and smiled at him.
"You are probably closer to it than the man who is," Ayla said. "You've provided more for that family than Larimar has."
They were approaching the main camp, and the people had started calling greetings to them.
"Do you think it will take very long to make a pole drag with a seat?" Ayla asked.
"If I can get some help and we start soon, maybe later this morning, we can probably have it done by afternoon," he said. "Why?"
"Then I should ask her if she would have time to try it this afternoon. She said that was what she wanted to do before she used it in front of other people."
"Go ahead and ask her. I'll ask Joharan and some others to help. I'm sure we'll get it done."
Jandalar grinned.
"It will be interesting to see how people react when they see her riding behind the horses."
Jandalar was working on cutting down a straight, sturdy sapling that was a good deal thicker than the size they usually selected for a travois. The stone axe head he was using had been shaped so that the thicker top was tapered up to a kind of point, and the cutting end napped into a narrow, thinning cross-section with a sharp, rounded bottom edge. The wooden handle had a hole gouged all the way through in one end into which the tapered top of the axe head could fit. It was affixed in such a way that each time a blow was struck, the axe head would wedge more firmly into the hole of the handle. The two pieces were firmly lashed together with wet rawhide that shrank and pulled tighter as it dried. A stone axe was not strong enough to cut straight across the trunk of a tree. The flint would shatter and break if used in that way. To fell a tree with such a tool, the cuts needed to be made at an angle, whittling down the tree until it broke apart. The stump often looked as though it had been chewed down by a beaver. Even then, stone chips usually spalled off the axe blade so that it needed constant resharpening. This could be done by using a carefully controlled hammer stone or pointed bone punch hit by a hammer stone to remove narrow slivers of stone to thin down the cutting edge again. Because he was a skilled flint napper, Jandalar was often called upon to cut down trees. He knew how to use an axe properly and how to resharpen one efficiently. Jandalar had just cut down a second tree of similar size when a group of men arrived, Joharan, along with Soliban and Rushamar, Manvalar, the leader of the third cave, and the son of his mate, Morazan, Kimaran, leader of the second cave, and Jondakam, his same-age nephew, Willemar, the trade master, and his apprentice, Tivonan, and his friend, Peladar, and Stivadal, the leader of the 26th cave, within whose territory this year's summer meeting was being held. 11 people had come to make one pole drag, 12 counting Jandalar. If she counted herself, 13. Ayla had made her first one by herself. They were curious, she thought. That's brought them. Most of the new arrivals were familiar with the contrivance she called a pole drag, which Ayla used with her horses to transport goods. It began with two poles made from whole trees with tapering tops, and all the branches were trimmed off. Depending upon the variety, the bark was sometimes removed as well, especially if it slipped off easily. The narrow ends were fastened together and attached to a horse at the withers with a harness of sturdy cords or leather thongs. The two trees angled out slightly in front and much more toward the back, with only the ends of the heavier base dragging on the ground, which created relatively little friction, making it fairly easy to pull, even with a heavy load. Cross pieces of wood, leather, or cordage, anything that could support a load, were attached to both poles across the space between. Jandalar explained to the ones who had come to help that he wanted to make a pole drag with special cross pieces put together in a certain way. Before long, more trees had been cut down, and a few suggestions offered and tried before they worked out something that seemed suitable. Ayla concluded they didn't need her, and while they were working, decided to get Zelandani. Taking Janela with her, she slipped away, heading towards the main meeting camp, thinking about the adaptations to a pole drag and the one they had made on their long return journey to Jandalar's home. When they came to a large river they had to cross, they constructed a bowl boat, similar to the kind the Mamutoi used to cross rivers, a frame of wood bent into the shape of a bowl and covered on the outside with a heavy, well-greased aurochs hide. It was simple to make, but a little difficult to control in the water. Jandalar told her about the boats the Sharamudoi made, dug out of a log, widened with steam, with a pointed prow on each end. They were much more difficult to make, but it was much easier to make them go where you wanted, he explained. The first time they crossed a river, they used the bowl boat to hold their things and themselves, and propelled it with small oars across the river while the horses swam behind. They repacked their things in panniers and saddle baskets, then decided to make a pole drag for Winnie to take the boat with them. Later, they realized that they could attach the bowl boat between the poles of the travois and let the horses swim across a river, pulling the load, while Ayla and Jandalar rode on their backs or swam along beside them. The bowl boat was lightweight, and since it floated, it kept their things dry. When they reached the other side of the next river, instead of emptying it, they decided to leave their things in the bowl boat, while the pole drag with the boat made crossing rivers easy and usually presented no problems traveling across open plains. When they had to move through woods or areas of high relief that required sharp turns, the long poles and the bowl-shaped boat could be a hindrance. They almost left them behind a few times, but didn't abandon them until they were much closer and had a much better reason. Ayla had told Zelandani earlier what they were planning, so she was ready when Ayla came for her. When they got back to the camp of the ninth cave, the men had moved closer to the fenced enclosure that had been made for the horses and didn't see them. The first slipped into the sleeping lodge used by Jandalar's family with the sleeping baby, while Ayla went to see what was happening with the pole drag seat. Jandalar had been right. With all the help it hadn't taken long to construct, it had a deep bench-like seat with a back between the two sturdy poles, with a step up to it. Jandalar had taken Winnie out of the enclosure and was strapping the conveyance on the mare with a harness arrangement of thongs across her chest and high on her shoulders.
"What are you going to do with that?"
Morazan said. He was still young enough to ask directly. It was not considered courteous for adults to be quite so blunt, but it was what all the others were thinking. Such directness might not have been appropriate for a mature Zelandani, but it wasn't wrong, just naive and unsophisticated. Experienced people knew how to be more subtle and implicit. Ayla, however, was used to candor. It was common and entirely appropriate for the Mamutoi to be frank and forthright. It was a cultural difference, although they had their own kinds of subtleties, and the clan could read body language as well as their sign language, and though, as a result, they couldn't lie, they did understand nuances and could be extremely discreet.
"I do have a particular idea of how to use it, but I'm still not sure if it will work. I'd like to try it out first, and if it doesn't work, it is a sturdy and well-made pole drag, and I will probably find another use for it," Ayla said.
While her reply didn't really answer his question, it satisfied the men. They assumed that she just didn't want to announce an experiment that might not work. No one liked to advertise their failures. Ayla was actually fairly certain it would work. She just didn't know if the first would be willing to use it. Jandalar started walking slowly back towards their camp, knowing that if he moved, the others would. Ayla went into the horse enclosure to settle the horses after all the excitement of so many people around, nodding to the men to acknowledge their leaving. She patted and stroked Gray, thinking what a beautiful young filly she was. Then she talked to Racer and scratched his favorite itchy parts. Horses were very social animals and liked being around their kind and others for whom they had affection. He was of an age that if he were living with wild horses, he'd be leaving his dam to run with a bachelor herd. But since Gray and Winnie were his only equine companions, he grew quite close to Gray and had become somewhat protective of his young sister. Ayla went out of the enclosure and approached Winnie, who was standing patiently with the pole drag behind her. As the woman hugged her neck, the mare put her head over Ayla's shoulder, a familiar position of closeness between the two. Jandalar had put a halter on the mare, since it was easier for him to direct her with it. Ayla thought it might be better to use it while the first was trying out her new means of transportation. Taking the lead attached to the halter, she headed towards their sleeping lodge. By the time she reached it, The men were walking back to the main camp, and Jandalar was inside the lodge talking to Zelandani and holding Janela, who was quite content.
"Shall we try it out?"
Jandalar said.
"Is everyone gone?"
the large woman asked.
"Yes, the men are gone, and no one else is in camp," Ayla said.
"Then I suppose this is as good a time as any,"
the first said. They walked out of the lodge, each of them glancing around to make sure no one else was there, then approached Winnie. They went around the back of the horse. Suddenly Ayla said,
"Wait a moment,"
and went into the summer dwelling. She came back out, holding a padded cushion, and placed it on the seat, which was made of several small logs lashed firmly together with strong cordage. A narrow back, perpendicular to the seat and made the same way, kept the cushion in place. Jandalar handed Ayla the infant, then turned to help Zelandani. But when the Danyar stepped onto the crosspiece of wooden logs made into a step that was close to the ground, the springy long poles gave a little, and Winnie took a step forward because of the shift in weight. The first quickly backed off.
"The horse moved," she said.
"I'll go hold her steady," Ayla said.
She went around to the front of the mare to calm her, holding the lead rope with one hand and the infant with the other. The horse sniffed at the baby's tummy, which made her giggle and her mother smile. Winnie and Janela were familiar with and completely comfortable around each other. The child had frequently ridden on the horse, in her mother's arms, or slung in her carrying blanket on a woman's back. She had also ridden on Racer with Jandalar and had been placed lightly on Gray's back while the man kept a secure hold on her, just so the two of them could get used to each other.
"Try it again,"
Ayla called out. Jandalar held out his hand for support, smiling at the large woman encouragingly. Zelandani wasn't used to being encouraged or urged to do anything. She was the one who usually took on that duty, and she gave Jandalar a hard look to see if he was patronizing her. In truth, her heart was pounding, though she did not want to admit to her fear. She wasn't sure why she had agreed to do this thing. Again, the fresh trees that were used as poles yielded as the first put her weight on the thinner logs that had been lashed together to form the step. But Ayla steadied the mare, and Jandalar's shoulder offered support to her. She reached for the seat, again logs tied close together with rawhide cordage, turned herself around, and sat on the cushion with a sigh of relief.
"Are you ready?" Ayla called back.
"Are you?"
Jandalar asked the Danyar quietly.
"As ready as I'll ever be, I suppose."
"Go ahead,"
Jandalar said, raising his voice a bit.
"Take it slow, Winnie,"
Ayla said, going forward while holding the lead. The horse started walking, pulling the sturdy pole drag and the first among those who served the great Earth Mother behind her. The woman grabbed the front edge of the seat as she felt herself being moved, but once Winnie got started, it wasn't bad, though she didn't let go of the seat. Ayla looked back to see how things were going and noticed Wolf sitting on his haunches watching them.
"Where have you been? You've been gone all day," she thought.
The ride wasn't smooth. There were a few bumps and dips along the way, and one place where one leg dropped into a ditch caused by a creek runoff, making the rider sway to the left, but the conveyance was soon righted when Ayla turned Winnie slightly. They headed toward the horse enclosure. It was a strange sensation to move without using her own feet, Zelandani thought. Of course, children who were carried by their parents were used to it, she realized, but she hadn't been small enough to be carried by anyone for many years, and riding on this pole-drag, moving seat wasn't the same. For one thing, she was facing backward, looking at where she had been, not where she was going. Before they reached the horse enclosure, Ayla started a wide turn that led them back to the Ninth Cave's camp. She saw a track that led in a direction different from the one they usually took to the main camp. She had noticed it before and wondered where it led, but never seemed to have time to follow it. This seemed like a good time. She started toward it, then looked back and caught Jandalar's eye. She indicated the unknown trail with a slight gesture. He nodded imperceptibly, hoping that their passenger wouldn't notice and object. Either she didn't notice or didn't object, as Ayla continued. Wolf had been trotting beside Jandalar, bringing up the rear, but loped to the front when Ayla changed direction. She had draped the lead rope across Winnie's neck. The horse would follow the woman's signals more easily than a lead rope attached to a halter. Then she put Jandalar in her carrying blanket on her back, where the child could look around, but wasn't a constant weight on her mother's arm. The trail led to the waterway known to the Ninth Cave as West River, and followed it for a short distance. Just as Ayla was wondering if she should turn back, she saw several familiar people ahead. She stopped the horse and walked back to Jandalar and Zelandani.
"I think we've reached Sunview, Zelandani," she said. "Do you want to go ahead and visit? And if so, do you want to stay on the pole drag?"
"Since we're here, we might as well visit. I might not get here again for some time. And I'm ready to get off. It's not bad sitting on the moving seat, but it can be a bit bumpy sometimes."
The woman stood up, and using Jandalar for a bit of balance and support, stepped down.
"Do you think you would find it convenient to use when we go to visit the sacred sites you want Ayla to see?"
Jandalar asked. "I think it could be useful, at least for part of the journey."
Ayla smiled.
"Jandalar! Ayla! Zelandani!"
a familiar voice called out. Ayla noticed a smile on Jandalar's face as she was turning around. Willemar was walking toward them, along with Stivadal, the leader of the 26th cave.
"How nice that you decided to come," Stivadal said. "I didn't know if the first would be able to visit Sunview."
"Summer meetings are always full for the Zelandania, but I do try to make at least one courtesy visit to the cave that hosts the meeting, Stivadal." "We do appreciate the effort," she said.
"It is an honor," the leader of the 26th said.
"And our pleasure,"
said a woman who had just arrived and was standing beside Stivadal. Ayla was sure the woman was Stivadal's mate, though she hadn't met her and didn't remember seeing her at the meeting camp. It made her look closer. She was younger than Stivadal, but there was something else. Her tunic hung on her thin frame, and she seemed wan and frail. Ayla wondered if she had been ill or suffered some grievous loss.
"I'm glad you're here," Stivadal said. "Danella was hoping to see the first and to meet Jandalar's mate. She hasn't been able to go to the meeting camp yet."
"You didn't tell me she was ill, or I would have come sooner, Stivadal," the first said.
"Our Zelandani has been here for her," Stivadal said. "I didn't want to bother you. I know how busy you are at summer meetings."
"Not too busy to see your mate."
"Perhaps later, after everyone else has seen you,"
Danella said to the first, then turned to the tall blonde man.
"But I would like to meet your mate, Jandalar. I've heard so much about her."
"Then you shall," he said, beckoning to Ayla.
She approached the woman with both hands out, palms up, in the traditional greeting of openness, showing she had nothing to hide. Then Jandalar began.
"Danella of the 26th cave of the Zelandani, mate of the leader Stivadal, may I present to you Ayla of the 9th cave of the Zelandani."
He continued with her usual introduction until he got to
"protected by the spirit of the cave bear." "You forgot, friend of horses, and the four-legged hunter she calls Wolf,"
Willemar added, chuckling. He had joined them, along with the rest of the men who had come to help make the new pole drag. Since they were in the area, Willemar suggested that they should stop by to visit Sunview, the home of the 26th cave of the Zelandani, who were hosting the summer meeting, and they had been invited to stay for a cup of tea. Most of the people who lived there were at the summer meeting camp, but a few were still at home, among them the leader's mate, who apparently was, or had been, ill, Ayla concluded, and wondered how long she had been sick and what her problem was. She glanced at Zelandani, who was looking at her. Their eyes met, and while nothing was said, she felt that the first was thinking the same thing.
"My names and ties are not nearly so interesting, but in the name of Dani, the great Earth Mother, you are welcome here, Ayla of the Ninth Cave of the Zelandani,"
Danella said.
"And I greet you, Danella of the 26th Cave of the Zelandani,"
Ayla said, as they took each other's hands.
"The sound of your speech is as interesting as your names and ties," Danella said. "It makes one think of faraway places. You must have some exciting stories to tell. I would like to hear some of them, Ayla."
Ayla couldn't help but smile. She was more than aware that her speech was different from that of other Zelandani. Most people tried to hide it when they noticed her accent, but Danella had such a charming and forthright manner that Ayla was immediately drawn to her. She reminded Ayla of the Mamutoi. Ayla wondered again what illness or difficulty had caused Danella's physical frailty, which contrasted so sharply with her warm and winning personality. She glanced at Zelandani and understood that the first also wanted to know and would find out before they left the camp. Janela was squirming, and Ayla thought she probably wanted to see what was going on and who her mother was talking to. She shifted the carrying blanket around so her baby could ride on her hip.
"This must be your Blessed of Dani infant, Janela,"
Danella said.
"Yes, that's a beautiful name. After Jandalar and you?"
Ayla nodded.
"She is as beautiful as her name,"
Danella said. Although it wasn't obvious, Ayla knew how to read the nuances of body language and detected a hint of sadness in the fleeting frown and slight wrinkling of her brow, and suddenly the reason for both Danella's weakness and sadness came to her. "She has miscarried quite late, or had a stillborn baby," Ayla thought, "and probably had a difficult pregnancy and very hard birth, and now had nothing to show for it. She is recovering from the strain on her body and grieving for her lost child." She looked toward the first, who was surreptitiously studying the young woman. Ayla thought she had likely guessed the same thing. She felt Wolf push against her leg and looked down. He was looking up at her, making a slight whine, which let her know that he wanted something. He looked at Danella, then back at her, and whined again. Did he sense something about the leader's mate? Wolves were always sensitive to weakness in others. When living in a hunting pack, it was the weak ones they generally attacked. But Wolf had formed a particularly close bond with the weak half-clan child whom Nezi had adopted when the wolf was very young and imprinting on his Mamutoi pack. Wolves of a pack adore their puppies, but humans were Wolf's pack. She knew he was drawn to human babies and children, and those that his wolf sense told him were weak, not to hunt them, but to bond with, as wild wolves did with their puppies. Ayla noticed that Danella seemed a little apprehensive.
"I think Wolf wants to meet you, Danella. Have you ever touched a living wolf?" she asked.
"No, of course not.
I've never been this close to one before. Why do you think he wants to meet me?"
"He is drawn to certain people sometimes. He loves babies. Janela crawls all over him, and even if she pulls his hair or pokes at his eyes or ears, he never seems to mind. When we first arrived at the Ninth Cave, he acted like this when he saw Jandalar's mother. He just wanted to meet Marthona."
Ayla suddenly wondered if Wolf had sensed that the woman, who had once been the leader of the largest cave of the Zelandani, had a weak heart.
"Would you like to meet him?"
"What do I have to do?"
Danella said. The visitors to Sunview were standing around watching. The ones who were familiar with Wolf and his ways.